Okay, so first, could you introduce yourself and your project's name?
Okay, hi, I am Irugu. I'm a one-man black metal project out here in Malaysia. My music is very atmospheric, very post-metal influenced, but also has a lot of technicality in it. I harken back to a lot of my favorite bands like Death, Opeth, but at the same time combining more modern black metal influences like Panopticon, Spectral Lore, and stuff like that. I also am anti-fascist, so a lot of my music has a political tinge to it. My new album is a sci-fi album, but it's got a bit of a political message that's wrapped up in a sprawling sci-fi story. So yeah, that's my project.
Good intro. Yeah, I guess I wanted to start with black metal from the anti-fascist perspective, because black metal has always been fascinating to me. That was music that I definitely got into preteen, early teenager. And it was always like posed to me as very transgressive against the establishment, all of this stuff. But it ended up Burzum, you know, those sorts of things being actually incredibly conservative, you know, in their worldview. And I'm wondering, for you playing black metal, coming from it from an anti-fascist perspective, is it almost like there needs to be a kind of response to some of this black metal that is fascist, conservative, when it has posed itself as transgressive, but is actually not transgressive at all?
I think there is a bit of a, there needs to be a response. I think it's a bit of a responsibility on all of us who are, you know, privileged enough to be making music. Because these guys are getting away with stuff that they really shouldn't be getting away with, you know? So I think as someone who, you know, is privileged enough to have a, you know, sort of a platform and play music and write music, record and release stuff, I think it is like it is something that needs to be done, because I don't think these guys should exist in this space at all, because they're horrible. They should be kicked out. So I think it's definitely a, you know, there should be a response, and it is a responsibility as well. And I mean, in terms of like my how transgressive this stuff is, like, I mean, it's like you said, right? Like, if you're gonna be like a conservative Nazi and doing black metal, that's not very transgressive. Like, you're not challenging anything when you do stuff like that, and you say stuff like that, or sing about stuff like that. I think to be actually challenging is to call out the people in power, or call out the systems that we live in, to try and force for change, good change. That is when it's transgressive, you know. But if you're going to talk about, you know, glorifying, you know, 1940s Germany, that's not really that transgressive, dude. It's you're bit, yeah.
In kind of the Bandcamp press release for this album, you talked about that it was a difficult process to make this. I'm wondering, for you, if you found the actual release of the album and the music therein kind of personal catharsis, or was it really difficult to get through?
I would say it's a bit of both, because I finished the album very early on. Like, musically, it was all written. I think it was completely done by, I'd say, like, this time last year, maybe. Like, I would say, yeah, maybe around April 2022, that the music of the album was done. So when it came to the lyrics, I don't write lyrics. You know, I don't have like a concept for an album before I you know, put stuff down. It's usually after all the music is done, I start to think about the lyrics a little more. And the story end of things just sort of aided in you know, getting a theme going. And, you know, when I write lyrics, it just makes it more focused, you know. That part was a bit difficult, the lyric, you know, the lyrical writing, because what I had in my head while I was writing the album and all the stuff that I'd gone through since the pandemic and everything, you know, I think I just wanted to sort of talk about it, but not be too explicit about it because, you know, I don't want to, you know, rile up too many feathers. So that part is a bit difficult. Like, how personal can this get? How, you know, how deep should I go into this? You know, but I did it in the end. I did the album as it is. You read the lyrics, but the release of the album. I mean, I think I don't know if it was catharsis so much more. It was relief, you know, because I sat on it for a very long time. A lot of work was put into the artwork, which is why, you know, it took a long time. So from this time last year, finishing up the whole thing to you know, January when it came out, the album was done. Like, it was pretty much finished, and we were working on the artwork, and it's like, you know, when it came out, it was just like, okay, that's gone. Like, bye. You know, like, I actually completely detached myself from the music. And it's weird now. I listen to it now sometimes. People, you know, play it for me or whatever. And I usually just go like, okay, how really, that's me? Like, I did that? Like, how did I write that? You know, and like the past like past few months I've been trying to relearn those songs on guitar, and it's like, how did I do this? Like, why did I make this so difficult? Like, you know, but it's like, yeah, so it's not really like, oh, it's just cathartic, like a release. It's like, okay, like, I don't have this on my back anymore. Like, it's out there. I don't think about it anymore. Like, you know, I don't have to keep saying on my Instagram, new album coming soon. You know, it's gone. So yeah.
I was thinking about the lyrical stuff because obviously, as you were talking about, how much of it is personal, how much can you read as personal versus like mostly a sci-fi concept. And what I found interesting was you have this character trying to flee someplace, going out and almost getting into worse outcomes and then returning. And I was wondering if the perspective was more along the lines of you can flee from your problems and where you're from, but it might end up worse, or you can flee from your problems, but you should probably try to help out the people around you where you're from.
I think it's a little bit of both. It's actually both. You know, some people like to talk about, you know, the grass is greener on the other side, especially when it comes to Malaysia. You know, you move out of Malaysia to escape from what's going on here, which I wouldn't judge anyone for doing so. But I always warn people when they say, you know, I want to go to Europe or whatever. The grass isn't greener on the other side. Like, don't have this expectation that it's some utopia over there. Because I did live in Europe for a while. I know how what things are like over there. It's not the best, some, you know, utopia that where everyone can be free, and you know, it's not. Like, it really isn't. We all know this. And at the same time, I think people who get to leave themselves, it's just such a privilege to, because our country is like collapsing as we speak right now, Malaysia. Like, well, it's awful, right? But and so people are leaving the country, right? They're trying to look for better opportunities elsewhere. But having that ability to do that is a privilege in and of itself. And I think that sort of privilege can be better spent helping the people here. Who need help, and people around us who are suffering every day. So yeah, it's a little bit of both, you know. Like, be careful of what you wish for, but at the same time, there are people around you who need your help, you know. Just because you have the privilege to leave, and you know, you don't have to just spend it on yourself all the time, you know. Like, help others. Like, I think it's a responsibility we all have as human beings. So yeah.
At the end of the Bandcamp, you had talked about working with the Seed Foundation, I think, SEED. Can you talk a little bit about their mission and how you got connected with them?
Well, I've heard of them for a long time. And I've been following their work, and I've always been like very impressed because they're one of the few, I mean, we have a very, very few NGOs in Malaysia helping out the LGBT community. And they specifically focus on trans people, and I've seen the work that they do, and I'm always very, very happy. And they seem like really nice people too. So how I got in touch with them was I literally just, you know, sent them a message on Instagram. I just said, hey, I'm releasing an album. I thought it'd be cool if I donated all the proceeds to you guys. And they were like, yeah, sure. So, yeah, that was basically it. I mean, I've always been a fan. Any group that are willing to help marginalized communities in any way, I'll always be supportive in some way. So, yeah.
So as somebody who's living in not just the United States, but Texas right now, which is actively clamping down on a lot of trans rights, especially, and obviously setting themselves up to start clamping down on the rest of the queer community, you know, that's just the plan. Yeah. How would you explain what's happening in Malaysia right now to an outsider who might be experiencing something semi-similar in his position?
Well, your worst nightmare, I think. Right. I won't speak for the LGBT community. But I don't want to talk over them, but put it this way, there's trans, like, if you're like a Malay Muslim in this country, and if you were to transition, you would be imprisoned and punished for that. You know, like, there are opportunities to transition, for example, but it's very hard to access. Being openly gay is illegal. And you know, if you are a Malay Muslim, you will be punished severely for that. Even if you're a non-Malay, the ostracization from the communities here, it's the heterosexual community here, would be unbelievable. It's like the path that the US is going down now, with the transgender community, you will end up where we are right now, you know, like, this is where it's heading. So yeah, it's the worst possible outcome here. Not the worst, I would say. Actually, I take that, not the worst. I think there are places where it's around the world where it's even like more horrible, but it's pretty shitty down here, and I think a lot of people would agree with that. Last year, for example, we had a drag event in Kuala Lumpur for Halloween, and it was shut down by the cops. The cops raided the event, and they arrested a people, and just for having a drag event, it's just recently as well, because Pride Month's coming up, so it's like Swatch, the watch company, are having a rainbow themed watches. Police raided and took all the watches away because they were spreading, you know, the gay agenda or whatever. And yeah, I mean, it's like there's no freedom of expression in that sense, you know, like, yeah, like, it's awful. So I don't blame people for leaving. But when I see people like the Seed Foundation who are doing so much to help people, I want to support them in every way. So, yeah.
Definitely feels like a little bit of preview of coming events on my end.
Yeah. Just, I mean, I think people like to say things like, oh, it can never get that bad. You know, it can never get that bad. You know, but like, that's the point, right? Like, it's always good to be vigilant against these kind of things, because next thing you know, you're like, you know, it's like you can't even go out the house anymore, you know, like. I mean, we've seen this around the world many times, so like, don't always be vigilant. I think it's always a good feeling to have.
So, more on the thematic aspects of the album. One of the things that kind of popped up to me: you are a one-person project, and a huge thematic thing on this album is the sense of isolation, right? Because this character is out in space. The only contact the character has is with this Lovecraftian nightmare creature at some point. I was wondering how much this, maybe your surroundings, the COVID pandemic, and being a one-man project all combined into that sense of isolation within the album.
I mean, COVID didn't just affect this album. I think it affected me, like, as a musician completely. but a lot of the themes of isolation in the album is actually a lot to do with being part of marginalized communities, right? Like, because I think as a Malaysian Indian, for example, you always end up feeling very alone, especially being, we're minority in the country, and a lot of the time you can feel very, very isolated, especially in certain spaces that are very, they are not very friendly to Malaysian Indians, for example. So that's one thing. And I've always loved sci-fi. Like, I've always loved it, like, ever since I was a kid. So, like, the idea of the isolation that one might feel if they were cast thrown out into space, versus what someone might feel like if they were the only Indian kid in a classroom, for example. Like, there's a, I think both of them had this very oppressive sort of, like, feeling about it, So I don't know, there's something about that being cast out into space and floating away and just like being alone, that's kind of, I think, can be very relatable for many marginalized people around the world. Because there's no one around to help sometimes, and you're like, just like, okay. In terms of like the Lovecraftian creature and all these things, it's like, I think that's very much a metaphor, like, for this character accepting himself. And then, obviously he goes back and fights his home planet and big space planet, space battle. But yeah, it's very much a metaphor for accepting yourself and your identity. Because I think one thing that a lot of people in marginalized communities will tell you is, at least at some point in our lives, we've tried to run away from our identity and who we are, because you don't want to be part of, we want to be part of the majority and what everyone else is. What everyone else looks like and talks like and feels like, so that is very much a part of that. And a lot of these things, like revelations, came to me, or at least were articulated better during the pandemic, I think, because, we're sitting at home, not really doing anything, so you have a lot of time to think to yourself. The past 3 years have been incredibly, like, isolating, right? Like, the pandemic and everything. Like, it definitely, I think, influenced a lot of... I wouldn't say it just influenced this album. I would say it influences and will continue to influence Irvu as a whole, because it's a project that started in the pandemic. And if you listen to my other music, aside from this album, like, including the ambient stuff, like, there is that feeling of isolation, being lost in space, and, So yeah, I don't know if I answered your question. Mm-hmm. I feel like I went on.
I think it's interesting with the creature, because if you look at a lot of science fiction, you think of Lovecraft. I know you like Mass Effect a lot. I was saying Massive Attack and Mass Effect at the same time. The Reapers in Mass Effect are similar kind of Lovecraftian creatures. Yeah, and those things within the fictional media we often consume are granters of madness or something terrible. Mm. And your creature is almost forcing your main character to accept something. Mm.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting kind of inversion of that trope.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's very... I don't know if that's... I can't say that was a conscious effort to make it like a reversal of that trope. I can't say it was a conscious thing, but I think there's always one of my favorite Lovecraft stories, right, is The Outsider. It's this guy who, I can't remember exactly, he walks around town and everyone's sort of like staring at him like, what the hell is this guy, and at the end of the story he looks at himself in the mirror and then has a complete breakdown because he realizes that he's been turned into this awful, like, Lovecraftian being, where basically if you look at it you go crazy. So I think like the inversion of, instead of the crazy outer dimensional Lovecraftian being this horrible creature that wants to destroy everything. Okay, yeah, so like, yeah, instead of him looking in the mirror and having a breakdown, why not have look in the mirror and actually accept himself, right? I guess that was probably what I was thinking, but I can't say it was like a conscious effort to be like, oh, you know what if the creature was a good guy? You know, like, and but the music like definitely influenced it a lot. Like that, the main riff in that song just reminded me very much of like a Lovecraftian monster, you know? Yeah.
I mean, you're also what we were talking about earlier in terms of, being anti-fascist black metal, taking influence. Lovecraft himself was, the shut-in,
Very
terrible
racist, yeah.
racist.
Yeah, yeah,
Is really interesting to take the seeds of these ideas and just like flip them on their heads to make them progressive and accepting.
yeah.
I think that's a really interesting way of flipping these influences, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, yeah, Lovecraft was a piece of shit, right? Like, I think if he came back to life now, we would all probably beat the crap out of him. Yeah, or like laugh at him because he's so pathetic. Like, I don't know if you've like read his life. It's he lived a very pathetic life. That's the only way I could describe it. It's nothing. It's not in like a. I mean, in some aspects, you know, you do feel a little sorry because he's like, you know, fucking poor as shit, and you know, like he was, like everyone was horrible to him. But at the same time, it's like, dude, you're such a weirdo. Like you, and honestly, like Lovecraft as well. Like if you've read a lot of his stories, after a while, you do kind of get sick of his prose and his stories because it always ends the same way. Like, oh, the character looked at something, it was some crazy you know, color out of space, and he lost his mind, and oh my God, he's gonna commit suicide now. Like, you know, like it's always like that. And like obviously the racism is unbelievable. Like, and it's so ridiculous, you know, when you read it. Like, it's so like it cannot get more over the top than this. Like this, the racism. Like at some point, like, you know, it's insane. Like, I mean, we all know the name of his cat, and we all know how he describes the cultists in Call of Cthulhu. And it's just like, dude, seriously? Like, really? Like you like oh, like you're racist, but you're doing it like this? Like, it's almost like you're a parody of yourself, you know? Like, yeah, I don't know, he was such a weirdo, but to change, to invert that trope to make it something a little positive. I can't remember who made this video. There's a great video on YouTube. I'll have to find it after this. But someone was talking about how someone made a short film that was very, very Lovecraftian in it. I can't remember the name, but it's this guy. It's a very Lovecraftian-esque story, and it's sort of like a fan film almost, but it's this guy who's gay, right? And he gets treated like the outsider, like the story that I get told you about by his family. And it's got this like very Lovecraftian like sort of tinge to it, where like, you know, like there's a, you know, like this crazy otherworldly like you know, feeling to it. But I think that's the thing. Like, I think it's someone, you know, like people who are in marginalized communities, like despite the racism, like when you read a story like The Outsider, it's hard not to relate to something like that, you know? Because I'm a guy who went to school and had kids run away from him because I'm brown, you know? Like it's hard not for me not to read a story like that and think that's me. Like I've gone through that, you know? Like, you know, like people have you know, man, I don't have to get into too much of the racist incidents in my past, but like it's endless, you know. I have endless amounts of stories of people locking the car door as I walk by, you know, like I'm about to, you know, jump into their car or whatever, or you know, cops looking at you funny or being stopped at a roadblock, you know. Like it's all like, you know, we're all like you know, all of us who are a bit marginalized or brown or Indian or like walking around like some these weird creatures that should not exist and should not be in this country, and it's hard for people to comprehend who we are and what we do, you know? Like, there's a Lovecraftian-esque thing to that, you know? And I think taking that and twisting it into a more positive sort of note and saying, oh yeah, this is who we are. Like, you know, we're like, this is what we do. Deal with it.
Yeah, it seems that Lovecraft was so dominated by fear of everything in his surroundings.
Yeah,
you know, not just the racism, like the pseudo agoraphobia, and, you know, just like, you said, it's like pathetic in the end.
Yeah, because like,
racism is pathetic, but, you know, just
it's fascinating to look back on it now, because where that racism comes from. This is something that I like to sort of look into, and where do people get their bigoted feelings from, right? And with Lovecraft, it's like very fascinating, because he was isolated. Like, I really don't know if I want to say this, but I have a feeling the dude was probably very mentally ill, and had some sort of like issues. Like, he had, like, you know, he definitely had issues with his parents and everyone around him. So I wonder if, like, that fear of the unknown that is so prevalent in his stories, I'm definitely very confident that it probably had to do with his racism too. You know, like, oh my God, the weird fish people, you know, like you can tell, like, there's a racist, xenophobic sort of thing to that, you know, because, like, I'm like, who are these people? Why are they coming to our country? Like, what do they want? You know, like, there is so much of that in his stories. It's gross, like, obviously. But I think understanding it is important, and twisting it for something, to make it something better, is good too. Because some of those stories, like I mentioned before, can be quite good and quite relatable. I'm not making excuses for his racism. I think he's a piece of shit. And if I met him today, I'd probably kick the shit out of him. But I think there's something to take away in from his art, because I have taken something away from a lot of his writings.
So, yeah, it feels like you're flipping the core emotion of his work is fear, and you're flipping it to acceptance. Because it can almost be this, it's exactly what you're saying about The Outsider. When you are in a marginalized community, you feel like that. But the thing is, being able to be in what you're talking, you know, anti-fascist networks, the Seed Foundation, finding other people who are actually not going to treat you like that,
then
looking in the mirror and just being like, no, this is just who I am, flips that fear on its head.
There's also an element of the fear of acceptance. You know, that's another thing as well. Fearing yourself and who you are, where you come from, and accepting that. Yeah, it's very much a part of that.
You were talking earlier about your previous ambient work, and obviously this pops up mostly in the song Reflection. I was wondering about the influence of Brian Eno, because my immediate thought when I listened to Reflection was the Apollo soundtrack.
Right. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that. I've been tracking that record down on vinyl. It's so good. Like, Brian Eno, he's a bit of a cliche among ambient circles. It's like, you know, anytime you go on a forum and like, oh, give me an ambient artist to recommend, someone, you know, immediately will comment Brian Eno, and it's like, oh God, you know, really again, Brian Eno. But it's like, how can you not love his work, like his ambient series, especially Number 4, On Land, and the Apollo soundtrack? Like, it's just so good. Like, you, like, for me, it's this perfect kind of ambient music, because you can put it on while you're about to go to sleep, or you can put it on while you're going for a drive at night, and like, it works anytime. And like, I don't know, every time I listen to those his ambient stuff, I always pick out something new, whether it be, you know, music for airports to On Land, or Paul there, or, you know, Paul soundtrack. I always pick out something new. I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of Brian Eno. Like, huge influence on me. Yeah,
because that also leads me to the second part. There is a lot of dynamic control within this album. I know you're a big fan of Mare Incognitum, and one of the things that has stood out about his work, and then this work as well, is that it is not just, we're not at 11 the whole time, you know. There are interludes, There Are Times to Breathe, the opening to Home is gorgeous, you know? And so I'm wondering for you, how much of that is just your natural writing process of allow for dynamics to move, or how much of it is you have to kind of consciously write a little bit to make sure we flow naturally between these kind of breathing places to massive fortissimo climaxes?
I think it's subconscious, because a lot of this album was written on the fly. Like, it was, you know, I would have like a main riff, and then I would record that, and then I would, you know, in my head, I would sort of hear the next part. And then I would just continue from there, and I would keep adding and adding and adding and adding, and then I'd have a whole song. So, like, for the first track, the title track, a lot of that was like, I wrote that song in like 3 days, I think, because like I just sat down, I would write, I recorded the first riff, and then like the first thing that you hear in the song, and then like I just came up with another variation of that, and then like another idea came, and I just tagged it on to that, and just went on and on and on and on. So in terms of the dynamics of it, I think it was very much subconscious, because when I hear this stuff in my head and it's, you know, sort of automatically piecing itself together in my head, the dynamics are definitely a part of it. So yeah, I think it is definitely a subconscious thing, and I think that's because of my influences in you know, like Maricord Nictum and Panopticon and all the stuff, you know, because I love their music. So I think subconsciously it influences me in a way. So yeah.
These are like my favorite guitar solos I've heard this year, I think. And so I want to point out that I'm saying this in a non-pejorative, very positive term. When I listen to it, it's not reminding me of kind of black metal tropes. There's not a ton of like, you know, sweep picking and things like that. Some of it, because they're like dual guitar leads or really colorful solos, actually reminds me of kind of classic rock sometimes, you know, kind of blasting out of that. I was wondering, for you as a soloist, what are you drawn to?
I love 80s hair metal. It's my guilty pleasure. I'm gonna go see Mr. Big in August. They're coming in Malaysia. Coming to Malaysia. I love Paul Gilbert. Like, that guy is such a great guitar player. I mean, as much as I love metal and I love black metal, I love the guitar. I love it as an instrument. And when I see people who are, you know, virtuosos at the instrument, depending on what kind of, you know, music they play, obviously, because, for example, I love Paul Gilbert, but then at the same time, I'm not really a big fan of Tosin Abasi, for example, right, from Animals as Leaders. But I love that 80s, like just, you know, the guitar guy he's the star of the show, and he gets all the spotlight, he gets the guitar solo, and it's sick, you know, like that's what drew me to this kind of music in the first place. The first piece of, like, you know, music I heard with like distorted guitars in it was Van Halen. Like that was
the blueprint. First
thing. I saw a video of, and I saw a video of Eddie Van Halen doing Eruption, and I was like, oh my god, I want to do that, you know, like, and then that's what set me off, right, and then now not look back since. But I'm so drawn to that side of, you know, music, because it's awesome. Like you cannot just, like, I don't know, there's something about it, like, you just, yeah, right, you just like listen to it and you're like, fuck yeah, you know, like guitar solos, yeah, you know, like it's sick, like, and some of them are so tasteful there, and there's something about the production too as well, the way the guitars in that era sound. Like, if you listen to, like, I mean, let's take an example, Racer X, right? Paul Gilbert's first band. If you just listen to the guitar sound on that album, I guarantee you will not find a more aggressive guitar sound. Like, you will not find anyone who picks his guitar as hard as he does. It's so visceral and, like, you know, like, in your face kind of guitar playing that I love. I love it when guitars do that, you know, like, just, like the Steve Vai Crossroads, you know, like it's, I just love it. I love it. It's so cool. I am unapologetic about my love for that music, that 80s guitar shred music. I mean, I'm a guitar player. That's the only answer I have. I'm biased. I want the guitar player to get the spotlight. I want the solo in the song, you know?
I think just in black metal, sometimes you will hear bands that really lean on not just distortion, but active dissonance. And I love my avant-garde metal, but having solos like that seems to boost all of the melodic nature for the album.
Yeah. So this is the thing, right? Like, this is a dilemma I have. Because I love, like, At the Gates. I love death, you know, very melodic and, you know. But I love Gore Guts, too. I fucking love Gore Guts, you know. So it's like, how do I balance the two? Because I want it to sound dissonant. If you listen to The Creature, for example, it's quite dissonant. Mm-hmm. If you listen to Fear and Lead, the intro, it's like very off-kilter and like you're like, oh my god, what the hell's going on? But I also want to combine a lot of the melodic side of things, you know, that you would get in like a band like a bit like At the Gates or Opeth or something, you know, or Edge of Sanity. So it's like, I don't know, there's always this battle of trying to combine the two. But then when I add the guitar solo, it does boost that melodic, you know, side of it. But I can't help it, man. Like, I won't play guitar solos. It's cool. I mean, because there are times where it's like, I do leads to service the song too. Like the ending of the title track, for example, has this crazy sweep arpeggio type thing going on. That's inspired by bands like Psilosis, who do a lot of this sweep picking sort of over chords, not to like kind of show off, but it's to have this sort of psychedelic feel to
it. It's very textural.
Yeah, it's very textual, right? It just adds a... It's very technical, but it adds like a... The effect is not like this, oh my god, look at me, I'm the guitar player, I'm shredding like crazy now. The effect is more like, you know, like you said, textural. It's like, it just adds another soundscape to the whole thing. So again, it's a constant battle for me between the, you know, the Joe Satriani, Steve Vai, like, you know, shred guitar, so guitar guy's the main guy. Versus like, you know, the avant-garde Gore Guts where it's like a wall of sound and, you know, yeah. So like, I love Devin Townsend, like, for example, you know, like I love his production. I love the way he does things. This album was me trying to, the sound of this album was me trying to do that, you know? So yeah, it's tough, you know, like it's cause I'm trying to combine a lot of these influences that I have. But then the guitar solo comes around.
So very different question, but especially, you know, there have been internet scenes and internet labels for a very long time and communities that way. Pandemic seemed to supercharge that in some ways. I'm wondering how you feel, if you feel like you're in two different scenes, both in your physical sense in Malaysia and with the anti-fascist black metal network that you work alongside, where one is physical and one is more ideological in terms of where you connect.
So the question is, what is like, is there a difference?
Yeah. Where do you feel with both of those? How do you feel connected?
The Malaysian scene, I'm connected to it in a different way. I'm actually connected to the Malaysian scene, not through Irreverent. Connected to it through my other band, which has a lineup and all of these things, right? We play shows and all that. People, I think in Malaysia, know about Irreverent, but it's like, you know, not, it's not like a, I would say like most of my audience is from around the world. Like more people from like outside of Malaysia know about Irreverent than Malaysia itself knows. Because the thing about Malaysia is to get around in the scene, you need to play live. It's like a requirement here. Like, you know, people first thing people ask you is, will you play live? People want to see shows. They want to go for shows, right? Especially now that things are back to normal almost. So... how I feel, it's I don't know, it's like personally I try not to think about it too much. Like the international sort of RABM sort of scene is very supportive and I'm very happy. But I also got a lot of great friends in the local scene. So yeah, I don't know, like for me I think how you asked that question, I try not to think about it too much, you know. I just try to focus on my own thing and support the other bands that I like and, you know, that I want to support. So, yeah. So I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question. It's just, I don't really think about it for some reason. Yeah.